ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, more experts cast doubt on whether the Coalition's new energy plan can lower household electricity bills. Also, the US President Donald Trump declares his fellow Republicans should vote to release the Epstein files. And Paralympic gold medal cyclist Paige Greco dies at the age of 28.
Paige lit up a room when she walked into it. She was quite quiet and unassuming, but a fierce competitor, an incredible team member.
Senior members of the Federal Coalition have today been spruiking their new energy plan. It promises to lower power bills and reduce emissions, but the ambition of achieving net zero emissions by 2050 has been dropped. If voted in at the next election, the Liberal leader, Susan Lee, says the Coalition will repeal the laws enshrining Labor's 2023 policies, including the reduction targets for 2030 and 2035. Many experts doubt the plan will cut electricity bills, and one pollster believes the opposition should be focusing more directly on policies to address the cost of living crisis. Kimberly Price reports.
It sounds good on paper, cheaper power bills and lower emissions. But as senior coalition figures promote its new energy plan, experts warn there's not enough detail to prove household energy bills will be lower if it's voted in at the next election. Professor Bruce Mountain is the director of the Victoria Energy Policy Centre.
If their policies are oriented towards cheaper electricity, getting rid of the inefficiencies in regulation and transmission expansion, then I think either party may well have a plausible case to claim that their policies will be cheaper. But frankly, I don't think either the opposition or the government have actually demonstrated that yet.
The Liberal and National parties met yesterday to form the Coalition's new energy policy. It would get rid of current net zero emission targets and ensure no coal-fired power plants are prematurely closed. The Coalition says it would lead to more affordable energy, but Bruce Mountain says how the opposition will achieve its goals is unclear.
State governments now are subsidising the continued operation of coal-fired plant, and I expect that to continue, if anything, to increase. And these are Labor governments often extending the operation of coal-fired plant and placing the risk and the cost onto taxpayers to fund the continued operation. So these are not coalition governments. So that's the actual reality. There's a gap between announcement of targets and actual delivered outcomes in energy.
The Coalition plans to use a range of technologies to lower emissions, including solar, carbon capture, and next-generation nuclear. Bruce Mountain thinks the Coalition will still be open to renewable energy.
They haven't ever said that they will only have technologies excluding batteries or solar or wind farms. I think they don't intend to set targets for the amount of that they have, but I think they've always had an open mind, although I think they are seeking to restrict just where many of those wind and solar farms might go.
While climate change was a key issue in May's federal election, polling suggests that's changed. Tony Barry is director of Redbridge Group.
Climate change is currently lower down on the order of issue priorities for Australians. Now, public opinion is never static. It's constantly changing.
He says the Coalition is struggling to connect with voters on key issues.
One of the stunning results from the poll this morning is that on the six most salient issues to voters in their considerations, the Labor Party leads in four. The Greens lead in one, which is climate change, and One Nation leads in immigration. The Coalition has no real estate in those top six issues. And that gives you very little to campaign on because simply you're losing every one of those issues. You know, where does your messaging go?
After suffering its worst election defeat in history in May, Tony Barry believes the focus for the Coalition needs to be on voters' key concerns.
The lowest hanging fruit is actually to go after that vote, which is most animated by cost of living pressures and its relationship to housing attainability, which came in at third spot with 8%. But for a lot of voters, cost of living and housing goes hand in hand because it's your capacity to rent or pay a mortgage or so forth or save for a deposit. So with 50% of the electorate nominating cost of living or housing as the number one issue, that is a really important area for the coalition to focus on, and for Labor for that matter.
Former Liberal strategist turned pollster Tony Barry from the Redbridge Group, Kimberly Price with that report. In the United States, the President Donald Trump has made another shock move, this time giving his Republican colleagues in the House of Representatives the go-ahead to vote in favour of releasing the Epstein files. Mr. Trump has now fiercely opposed the release of the files, which are made up of documents relating to the criminal investigation of the late Jeffrey Epstein for the sex trafficking of young girls. It's well known Mr. Trump was a long-time associate of the pedophile, but he's always denied any wrongdoing. Will Partlett is an associate professor at the University of Melbourne Law School, and I asked him why Donald Trump has reversed his position in such a dramatic fashion.
Good question. I mean, it's a significant turnaround. He's been, for at least a month, he's been trying to resist the release of these files. I think the real reason is that it was splitting his coalition. You know, he has this kind of relatively fragile coalition of kind of quite extreme MAGA conspiracy theory driven supporters who have quite a few seats in the House of Representatives, in particular the lower house of U.S. Congress, who were actually thinking of really going to breaking with the president. For the first time, we've seen, you know, members of his own party openly challenging President Trump, and that's new for him. He's had a kind of an iron control over all factions of his party, but as he was losing control of these representatives, I think he realized that he'd better off just cut his losses and just say, look, I give up, go ahead and release it. And, you know, I think there's some advantages potentially to full release as well, but I think in a way it was to try to keep that coalition together.
Why are so many Republicans who usually seem to blindly follow or unequivocally support the president, why are so many so agitated about the Epstein case that they want to see these files released?
Well, on this case, they're hearing from their constituents, and their constituents who elected them to office and who will have to re-elect them next year in the 2026 midterms are furious about this. I mean, there are a lot of people who don't normally vote in the United States who are now part of the Trump coalition who really are, this is one of the central issues. They see conspiracy, you know, these interlocking elites and Epstein is kind of exhibit A and all of that. And they want this out because they see this as, you know, this is why they elected these representatives. This is why they elected Trump, to get this information out there, to expose transparency to what they see as a kind of overall kind of elite conspiracy.
Dr. Partlett, on that question of Trump supporters, what's happened to his relationship with the congresswoman from Georgia, Marjorie Taylor Greene? She was once a huge supporter, but they've had a big falling out.
That whole relationship kind of sums up what's happening here, which is, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is a huge Trump supporter, who comes from a kind of extreme wing of the MAGA coalition within the Trump support. And she's, you know, for the first time really started to criticize the president, you know, and he's been criticizing her. And, you know, we've rarely seen him in open tension with the MAGA part of his coalition. So the fact that she was willing to really criticize him was a suggestion that he was losing significant parts of that MAGA coalition. So it further sums up, I think, what he's concerned about is that he would be losing, you know, a big part of his coalition, one that's got a lot of energy and that a lot of voters care about. So, yeah, Marjorie Taylor Greene sums that whole process up in one relationship.
We saw documents released last week that saw the late Jeffrey Epstein saying that Trump knew about the girls. What do you think? Is Trump right? He has nothing to fear? Or do you think these files could reveal some more information that's damaging to the president?
I don't know, in short. But it's pretty clear that for a long time he did not want more information revealed. So it's possible that we're going to see more problematic releases for the president and for Trump himself. And, you know, it's very clear that what's already been released has damaged his political brand, has damaged his popularity, has led to a split in his coalition. So I think in this regard, you know, Trump is concerned, but at this stage, he's got to try to say, look, I don't want to get in the way of this anymore. And then he's just going to try to spin this as like, oh, this is actually, most of it's about the Democrats. And of course, an interesting question now is he's now going to use his control of the Department of Justice to investigate Democrats. And that could also, you know, it could help him to frame this narrative a little bit more around it. Because of course, he's got to try to spin this.
Yeah, he's going after, of course, the former president, Bill Clinton, too, and his links with Jeffrey Epstein. Dr. Partlett, explain the process for us. So it looks like with about half congressional Republicans or half of the Republicans in the House of Representatives going to vote in favour of the release, say that gets through, what happens then in the Senate?
Well, I mean, so if we get half of the Republicans, the first thing to say is that you're going to get a veto-proof majority in the lower house, in the House of Representatives, which is significant. So Trump couldn't have even vetoed this if he wanted to. And it's pretty likely that if, you know, the Senate, you might get some defectors in the Senate as well to push that number up as well to a, because of course it would have to go through the Senate. And of course, what we're looking at here is essentially an order to the Department of Justice, who controls these documents, to release them. And, you know, so really it is the first time we've seen Donald Trump lose control of Congress, really. Like, he's potentially losing control of Congress here. And so what he's going to try to do now is try to spin it. And he might, you know, and I think there's a lot of discussion too around if there are ongoing investigations that he is ordering, then the DOJ, the Department of Justice, can just say, oh, well, these are classified until we finish our investigation. So there's going to be still some more games playing going on. But yeah, it's pretty significant from a constitutional point of view in the sense that he really has lost a significant percentage of his support in the House of Representatives and in potentially even in the Senate.
Will Partlett is an associate professor at the Melbourne Uni Law School. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has rejected a proposal from Turkey that the two nations co-host next year's COP global climate meeting. They've been in a diplomatic deadlock over the issue for months. The Australian government wants to stage the event in Adelaide, in part to draw the world's attention to the effect climate change is having on smaller Pacific Island nations. For the latest, I spoke to the ABC's foreign affairs reporter, Stephen Jedgetts. Stephen, what exactly has Turkey proposed to the Australian government, and why has the Prime Minister, Mr. Albanese, decided to refuse that offer?
Well, we're not 100% certain, Sam, because we don't have a copy of the correspondence between Prime Minister Albanese and President Erdogan. But what international reporting suggests is that Turkey has indeed, as we've suggested previously, suggested a co-presidency with Australia, which effectively means that they split responsibility for negotiations, responsibility for hosting, and responsibility for the whole event. Now, that is a proposal which Australia is not willing to entertain, and the Prime Minister has absolutely made that clear today. Australia has been open to the idea of perhaps co-hosting some events, in other words, perhaps leaving the presidency with Australia but allowing Turkey to co-host ancillary events. But the very clear vibe from the Prime Minister this morning, and what the Australian government has been saying privately now for a while, is that a co-presidency, where you truly do split both hosting duties and the event as well as the presidency and responsibility for driving forward climate action, is simply not workable, and that it's specifically not permitted under United Nations rules. Let's take a listen to what Anthony Albanese had to say on this, speaking earlier today.
We won't be co-hosting because co-hosting isn't provided for under the rules of the UNFCCC. So that's not an option, and people are aware that that's not an option, which is why it's been ruled out.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese. And Stephen, the Prime Minister and the wider government emphasises that Australia wants to host the COP summit next year to focus the climate change argument, the concerns on what's happening in the Pacific. You report a lot from the Pacific nations. What are they saying about the prospect that COP won't come to the Southern Hemisphere?
Yeah, there's obvious frustration amongst some Pacific leaders, including some who've spoken to the ABC. The feeling is that it's primarily Turkey rather than Australia to blame for this. Yes, there's been a bit of grumbling about the fact that the government perhaps didn't put its full shoulder to the wheel behind this bid as soon as it could have. There's a bit of grumbling, for example, that the Prime Minister hasn't made the trip to COP in Brazil to force his case. But overall, most Pacific officials we've spoken to recognise that the fact that there is a deadlock, responsibility for that primarily rests on Turkey's shoulder. Some Pacific nations were a little bit lukewarm about the Pacific COP when it was first proposed by Australia, but most seem to have really come around to the idea. And I think it's fair to say that if this does fall over, if a compromise can't be reached and we are forced to host this event in Germany, in Bonn, at the UNFCCC headquarters instead of Australia, there will be a real sense of a missed opportunity in the Pacific.
We saw on the ABC's Insiders program yesterday, the Foreign Minister Penny Wong refused to confirm or even comment on reports that if COP were to come to Adelaide, it would cost as much as $2 billion. Has anything more been said today about the possible cost if it is in Australia?
Not today, but over the weekend and last week, we've seen a few politicians comment on this. The $2 billion figure has never been confirmed by the government, although it's in the ballpark with other figures which have been doing the rounds. Separately, I've been told that one early estimate was around the $1.4 or $1.5 billion mark, but that's never been formally confirmed by the government. The Prime Minister's dismissed it as nothing more than commentary. I think one thing you can say is that it will not be cheap. Even if you get a smaller COP than the ones we've seen in recent years, with perhaps 30 or 40,000 people rather than 80 or so, it's still a big and expensive exercise. The government, though, argues that that money will come back with interest because it will be such a boon for Australia's renewable energy industry. That shouldn't hide the fact, though, that the price tag is substantial.
Stephen Jedgetts is the ABC's foreign affairs reporter. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. In the Australian Capital Territory, more than 70 schools have remained closed today after they were found to have used sand imported from China that is possibly contaminated with asbestos. Schools in WA, South Australia and Tasmania are also affected. And New Zealand is now also removing the potentially contaminated product from schools and childcare centres there. As Julia Bergen reports, here in Australia, the states and territories aren't taking a uniform approach to dealing with the scare.
76 schools in Western Australia, 139 in South Australia, and more than 70 in Canberra have all been found to contain sand products potentially containing asbestos. Other states have also issued alerts. The responses from each jurisdiction, however, have been very different.
Our legislation here in the ACT requires us, regardless of the risk, to eliminate the risk as far as reasonably practical, and so that's the work that we're doing now.
That's ACT Education and Early Childhood Minister Yvette Berry, who today oversaw the closure of more than 70 public schools.
We're really hopeful that we'll be able to get across all our schools today to eliminate all of the sand that's been identified across all our schools. As soon as we have information, we'll make sure we let families know. Schools have different degrees of the sand being spread across the school environment, so once we have a better picture, we'll be able to let families know.
In South Australia, Education Minister Blair Boyer says the approach has been more case-specific.
The vast majority, I think it's about 94 where the product is sealed, about 24 where the product was open, about 8 that have a type of this sand which is not on the recalled list, and then there's about 13 cases where follow-ups are being made to determine whether or not it is a product that's on the list and what the status of the sand is.
The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission issued a national recall notice on Sunday following lab testing of children's coloured sand play products stocked in stores like Kmart, Target, Woolworths and Officeworks. All came up positive for asbestos. Despite the national call to action, regulations vary between states and territories, and head of the Asbestos Disease Society of Australia, Melita Markey, says that creates a patchy response.
The different agencies get together and meet, and they come up with what they consider to be a good national approach, but then it's all up to the individual states whether they adopt it. So, for example, the Federal Asbestos Eradication Agency, they came out with a strategic plan not every state signed on to that immediately, and then they could pick or choose what parts they adopted.
Melita Markey says those inconsistencies exist right across the board. She says while the ACT is leading the response to the asbestos sand scare, New South Wales is far ahead in terms of investing funds into asbestos health research. And Queensland, it leads the way on asbestos communication.
That is the challenge. Every jurisdiction has their own views about how things should be done.
And Melita Markey says while it's good schools are acting to eradicate asbestos sand products, the industry needs to be far more proactive in identifying and removing the toxic substance.
I'm actually about to publish some photos on my Facebook page today. I snapped them. There's a childcare centre not far from where I live, aging and broken asbestos all along the back fence there, and nobody's done anything for 2 weeks with it. To me, we're focusing on something that's very immediate, but what about the long-term effects of children in these ageing, deteriorating schools around Australia? Let's start looking at the bigger picture of removing that.
The problem is not just isolated to Australia. In New Zealand, local media are reporting at least 5 schools are closed today for asbestos testing.
Julia Bergen reporting, and the ACT government says some of the schools it had closed today will reopen tomorrow. The Australian cycling community is in mourning after the shock death of Paralympic gold medal cyclist Paige Greco at the age of 28. She won gold at the 2020 Tokyo Games and broke a world record. The Greco family says Paige died in her Adelaide home after a sudden medical episode. She's being remembered not only for her achievements in sport, but her kindness and determination too. Kathleen O'Connor prepared this report.
One lap to go for Paige Greco. This is going to be a special day.
It was a defining moment in her career.
Another remarkable athlete about to write another chapter in Paralympic history. It'll be Paige Greco of Australia who takes the gold medal in a time of 350.815.
Cyclist Paige Greco from Adelaide securing Australia's first gold medal of the 2020 Tokyo Paralympic Games in the women's C1-C3 3,000-metre individual pursuit and setting a new world record.
And not only has she taken a gold medal here at the Tokyo Paralympics, she has also set another world record for the C3 class in that ride.
In those games, the young cyclist went on to win bronze in the C1-C3 road race, all with a big smile on her face.
Paige lit up a room when she walked into it. She was quite quiet and unassuming, but a fierce competitor, an incredible team member.
Cade McLaughlin is the chef de mission of the Australian Paralympic team and was a team member of Paige's at the Tokyo 2020 Paralympics.
I remember giving her a big hug when I congratulated her for her gold medal. And she was so unassuming and, you know, not a loud person, just, you know, went about her business really methodically. But when I congratulated for that, her whole face lit up.
Paige Greco is being remembered for her kindness and warm spirit. The 28-year-old died after experiencing a sudden medical episode at her home in Adelaide.
Everyone, whenever you turn to see Paige, she just had her eyes just smiled at you as well. She was just amazing. But when she won that medal, I know how proud she was. And, you know, that's probably a memory that will sit with me. And I'm very proud to have led that team. But, you know, she was just an incredible athlete.
At a young age, Paige was diagnosed with cerebral palsy, but stopped at nothing to become a big name in cycling. She once spoke of the uncertainty she faced.
When I was younger, the doctors did say to my parents that I might not be able to run and I would have trouble doing exercise. I think I've always had that drive in me that, yeah, okay, I do have cerebral palsy, but I'm still going to compete because that's what I love to do.
She started competing as a cyclist in 2018. Her international debut came at the 2019 Paracycling Track World Championships in the Netherlands, where she broke 3 world records. And in 2022, 2 years after her stunning performance in Tokyo, she was awarded a Medal of the Order of Australia for services to sport.
Oh, that feeling when I crossed the line. I love to win. I love when I race to always strive to get on that podium.
Teammate Kate McLaughlin says the cycling and Paralympic community is in shock following the news of Paige Greco's death. Her mother released a statement saying, "Paige meant everything to us. Her kindness, her determination and her warmth touched our family every single day. She brought so much joy and pride into our lives and the pain of her passing is something we will carry forever. Paralympics Australia Chief Executive Cameron Murray says Paige Greco was admired for her character and the way she represented her country, calling her an extraordinary athlete, but more importantly, a remarkable person. Chef de mission of the Australian Paralympic team, Kate McLaughlin, hopes to celebrate her teammates' life with the community in coming weeks.
Paige will be remembered as a beautiful, kind, fiercely competitive Paralympian who was so proud of her achievements, so proud of being part of that paracycling community, and more broadly, she was incredibly proud to be part of our Australian Paralympic mob.
What sad news. That's Kate McLaughlin, the chef de mission of the Australian Paralympic team. Kathleen O'Connor reporting. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on the ABC Listen app, and we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump's been all over the place with his tariffs, but the reality is the US is now making billions from them. But how is the American economy faring overall, just a year since his election? Today, Penny Goldberg, professor of economics at Yale University, on whether the tariffs are really as bad as first feared. Look for the ABC News Daily Podcast on the ABC Listen app.